So, how much did you think this week? How much did you think this week? George Bernard Shaw said one time something that probably a lot of people would consider somewhat insulting. He said, few people think more than two or three times a year. He said, I've made an international reputation for myself by thinking once or twice a week. You might think, well, what did he mean? We're thinking all the time. Your mind is continually going. We're always thinking. How much did I think this week? Well, tell me how many hours I was awake. And then I thought some while I was asleep, too, that I've forgotten most of. But we think all the time. Well, that's not what he meant. He is referring to pondering the deep issues of life. He was talking about deep, deep thinking. We're always thinking, but what is the depth of our thinking? Or you might describe, what is the quality of our thinking? Where does that go? Eleanor Roosevelt spoke to the depth of how people think one time. She put it in an interesting way. She said, great minds discuss ideas. Average minds discuss events. Small minds discuss people. And I would say, stop at the grocery store the next time you're there and look at the magazine rack and identify what most of our thinking is directed to in terms of just magazines. And you can talk about other forms of entertainment and information. You will see some magazines that have in-depth thought given to issues of the day, but a lot of them are about people and events. And that's where most of the appeal is, and that's where most of them are sold, because that's what our minds are mostly on, people and events and things. And it's a shame, because one of God's greatest works in his creation, probably the greatest element of his physical creation, is the human mind. There's nothing like the human brain and the spirit in man that he created to go into it, and that is all about thinking. And I think we all know that probably our potential and capacity is never used to the greatest extent that it could be. But on the other hand, you wonder if to try to get the world to think more would be a good thing. Because it's our thinking that's gotten us into the messes that we find ourselves in. I wonder if God ever says, man, I wish they would think more. No, wait, no, that's not. Maybe they don't need to think more. It's not that we need to think more, that we need to think along a certain path. Because God said himself, a famous scripture in Isaiah 55, my thoughts are not your thoughts. God thinks. We're created in his image, we think. But he said, my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. God says about human thinking, we just are not on the same wavelength. We don't think the same way. Now, there can be brilliant people who do think. As George Bernard Shaw said, you know, he made an international reputation for himself for giving little time to that. There have been others who've done the same way. The greatest thinkers, though, the greatest philosophers, the deepest human thinkers have still not thought God's way. They are influenced by the world around them. They're influenced by their own desires. They're influenced by things that, as the Bible says, seems right to man, but are not godly. I was working on this message this morning and remembered this book I have on my bookshelf, Seven Men Who Rule the World from the Grave. And these seven men are Charles Darwin, Karl Marx, Julius Wellhausen, John Dewey, Sigmund Freud, John Maynard Keynes, and Soren Kierkegaard. And the cover of the book says, though their bodies lie cold and dormant, the grave cannot contain the influence these seven men have had on today's world. They continue to rule because they have altered the thinking of society. They generated philosophies that have been ardently grasped by masses of people, but are erroneous and anti-scriptural. Today, these ideas pervade our schools, businesses, homes, even the church. So the whole book is about ideas in how a few people changed the thinking of the world. Most of the world just sort of went along with it, but the movers and shakers and those of influence were affected by their influence. Deep thinkers, brand new ideas. But did they lead the world closer to thinking God's way? And the answer is no. God simply does not use his mind the same way as man. He thinks differently. He uses his mind differently. And for us to be on the same wavelength as God, we have to change our thinking. And we have to change because God's not going to dumb down. God is not going to dumb down. We have to think differently. And yet, for us to be here today, we did at some point start thinking differently. And that was God working. God began to work in our minds. We sometimes use the phrase, God opened my mind. But what do we mean by that? We mean, to put it differently, he made us think differently. He opened our mind to thinking about life in a different way. And if we showed that we were willing to change our thinking based on what we were learning, and then that we were willing to change our behavior based on how we were thinking, if we were willing to do that, he would continue to give us more and more understanding. But God put us on a new way of thinking. He put us on a brand new way of thinking, and he, once we were put there, he designed us to be on a path that would continue all of our lives. So of all people, we should be thinkers. We should be thinkers. In Romans 12 and verse 2, Paul talks about this. He actually talks about it a lot. And when you study the Bible from this perspective of thinking, you find that God used a lot of people to write a lot about this, about the way we think. Here's one way that Paul put it in Romans 12, 2. He said, do not be conformed to this world. How do we go about not being conformed to this world? Well, he said it begins with the thinking. He goes on to say, but be transformed, be changed by the renewing of your mind. It all has to do totally with thinking. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Everything we do as Christians goes back to how are we thinking about this? And to be able to think God's way. The change, the transforming, the conversion comes in the way that we think because of a simple principle that we find in Proverbs 23:7. That says, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. Conversion begins in the heart. The things that we do in our behavior as Christians begin with the way we think. As he thinks in his heart, so is he. Really strong principle. In 1 Peter chapter 1, Peter wrote about this. In 1 Peter 1 and verse 13, 1 Peter 1:13. He said, therefore, gird up the loins of your mind. What does that mean? Gird up the loins of your mind. You ever heard anybody say that in the world today? You ever hear a sportscaster say, well, he sure blew that play. He needs to gird up the loins of his mind. You know, what I read one time was that in that age they wore these robes, and to run, they would gather up the robes, you know, in their hands and tighten them up and gird them around their waist so their legs would be free to run. And it, you know, it's to gather up these things, but it has to do with the mind, the way we think. And then it says, and be sober. Well, is Peter addressing a drinking problem in the church? No. The word for sober in Greek is nepho, And it means to be free from intoxicants. That is the word that they would use for somebody who needed to sober up from alcohol. But metaphorically, it was used in connection with being watchful. To be watchful. Putting these two together, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, it means to be watchful with the mind. There's a related word, eknepho, which is translated awake in the Bible very often, and it means literally to return to one's senses from drunkenness. Eknepho, to return to one's senses. So this whole concept of soberness as it relates to the mind has to do with getting away from the stupor, the intoxicating effect of the way that the world thinks. Our minds need to be different. There are all sorts of influences ranging from wrong doctrines to lust of the flesh and just wrong-headed thinking. In verse 14, he says, as obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lusts, as in your ignorance. What is lust but a way of thinking? Lust is completely about thinking. Now, actions may follow lustful thoughts, but lust itself has to do only with the thinking in the mind. It's what is going on in the mind. Now, ignorance, he says, as we did in our ignorance. Ignorance can be from a lack of knowledge, or it can be from a lack of thinking deeply about knowledge. In other words, we can be given knowledge. Knowledge can be available, but if we don't think about that knowledge very much, we can stay in ignorance as to the depth of the knowledge that we've been given. So he's saying to us, as obedient children, don't conform ourselves. Paul talked about being transformed. Peter said, don't conform to the lust of that we used to have in our ignorance, the way we thought at that time. But as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Because it is written, be holy for I am holy. Now, being holy is not a state of emotion. It's a pattern of behavior and action and thinking all together. It's a way of living. But to understand holiness and the depths of holiness, does that not require a lot of thought about how is God holy? He says, it's written, be holy for I am holy. To really grasp what that means, we have to think about that. We have to study on that. What does that mean to be holy as I am holy? There's something else that Paul wrote about this. Apparently, Peter and Paul thought about thinking quite a bit. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 3. 2 Corinthians 10, 3. Paul said, for though we walk in the flesh, our war is not in the flesh. Our war is not in the flesh. We do not war according to the flesh. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds. Now, what are the strongest holds on people? Well, he describes some in verse 5. Casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. Is this not the biggest battle for Christians? To bring our thoughts into captivity. To bring our thoughts into captivity. Again, we have to think about thinking because that's where the battle is won and lost. It's the Isaiah 55 factor. My thoughts are not your thoughts. And as humans, we have to recognize that and be enjoined in this striving to think the way God thinks because it is going to be a battle. So how can we deal with this in life? It's certainly not something to exhaustively cover in one sermon. There's so much to it, but I do want to talk today about one of the best ways to approach this, and that is by doing something that really few people do constructively. There is a biblical term for it. Most people today, when they hear that term, they think of Eastern or New Age types of philosophies. But the Bible is full of instruction on the thoughts, the mind, the heart, the attitude, all of these different words that refer to the processes that govern what goes on inside our heads. And one of the most powerful tools, probably the most powerful tool that will properly govern our thinking, and it's one of the most overlooked ways to draw closer to God, is meditation. Meditation. You don't hear a lot these days about meditation, except in the context of, as I said, these Eastern and New Age religions and philosophies. And that's not going to take you anywhere except in the wrong direction. I did a brief internet search and saw some quotes about meditation today. Here's one. The goal of meditation isn't to control your thoughts. It's to stop letting them control you. Look at that. The goal of meditation isn't to control your thoughts. It's to stop letting them control you. Okay. Another one. True meditation has no direction or goal. It is pure, wordless surrender. Pure, silent prayer. Say what? Another one. The purpose of meditation is soul contact. And ultimately, union with the soul. Its whole object is to enable one to become an outer manifestation, what one is in inner reality. I don't even know what you're saying. You know, yet that sounds deep to some people. I know it sounds deep, but you know what? When you look at that very carefully, not only does it sound a little silly, but it's a lie. It is a lie. That is not what the Bible talks about. Meditation means controlled thinking. It means directional thinking, guided thinking. The word means to ponder, to consider, to muse, to study. And it's also a challenge. It's a challenge to go that deep. That's what George Bernard Shaw was talking about. A lot of people don't go that deeply, but that's what the Bible is talking about when it speaks to meditation. Henry Ford, you probably heard his famous quote. Henry Ford said, "Thinking is the hardest work there is, which is why so few people engage in it." It is hard to work just with the mind, but the Bible is very clear about that. Why would Ford say that? Why would George Bernard Shaw say that? Why would Eleanor Roosevelt say what she said? Well, they were hitting on something that is core to the nature of most humans, and that is, it is easy for us to be comfortable with what's easy. It's easier for us to be comfortable with what's easy. Meditation takes work. It takes focus. It takes concentration. It takes dedication. And it's a challenge. What makes it difficult in today's age? Part of it is that we're just so busy. We get caught up doing so many things. And they're not all bad things. In fact, most of them can be good things. I don't think we worry a lot about people in the church going out just doing a whole lot of bad things. But there is concern about the busyness of life. Socializing, working, being entertained, sometimes just being tired. Somebody told me at the office yesterday, they said, "My mind just needs a rest." And it's true. Sometimes you get there. You're just too tired to think. And that's one of the challenges. And what that results in, though, is a lack of deep, reflective thought. Meditation does not grow well in the soil of busyness. Meditation does not grow well in the soil of busyness or tiredness. You know, remember one of the warnings that Jesus gave about the end times? And he said, you know, don't be caught up in drunkenness and carousing. And what was that other one? The cares of this life. the cares of this life, drunkenness and carousing can be sinful. They are sinful. But the cares of this life, a lot of times, they're not sinful. They're just so many cares of life. Of and by themselves, not sinful, but when you pile them all together, they push out things that are more important. The cares of this life. And meditation is one of the first victims because it needs time. It needs time. There's another reason that's even referred to in the Bible, and that is sometimes pondering deeply about life can be painful. Sometimes there are painful things. There was a time in David's life. Actually, it was Asaph. But he wrote in Psalm 73, verse 16, about some of the things that are just unfair in life. And he really was thinking about them. But he mentioned there, and we'll go there a little bit later. You don't have to turn there now. But he said, when I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me. It was confusing. He was not coming up with an answer, and it just seemed wrong. And the more he thought about it, the more he went down into this frustration. And so, yes, it can be painful. Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1:13, he said, I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. And he said, this grievous task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. In one of the marginal notes, for exercise as afflicted. Solomon devoted a lot of time to thinking about it. And what follows in his introduction there was his frustration about thinking and experimenting with life. But Solomon unknowingly also told us something about the lesson of thinking solo. If we go solo, if we're going to fly that route by ourselves, apart from God, it will be painful. It will be difficult. Thinking by yourself about life, apart from the knowledge of God and the understanding of God, will be painful. So yes, deep thinking can be challenging. It can be painful. It can be hard work. But what's the option? What's the option? The result of not working hard to think or resisting meditation because it's hard, what happens is that we turn our thinking over to others too often. We can actually turn our thinking over to other people. What do I mean by that? Well, you know how it is in the world. Satan wants to drive the bus. Satan does drive the bus in the world today. And he drives the thinking. And if we don't set aside time to really think deeply in the things of God, we will have the thoughts of other people, and of the world, coming into our heads all the time. It'll be pervasive, because not only are we thinking all the time, so are other people, and they are expressing their thoughts, and we're listening, and we are affected by that. Satan wants to do the thinking for us. And since the mind never goes blank, except when you're trying to remember somebody's name, since the mind goes blank, it will be filled. The mind doesn't go blank, so it's going to be filled with something. And Satan's goal is to try to just push as many thoughts into our minds as he can. Any thoughts, as long as they're not God's. It's always going to be doing that. You know, when we read that Christ was tempted in all points as we are, yet without sin, maybe we don't consider that living in this world, he had the same challenges with thinking that we do. He was tempted in that, the same way we are. He had the same needs. He had to deal with that as well. And he did so. He dealt with that challenge in a very conscious way, and he dealt with it successfully. It's a great example in Mark chapter 6. Let's go to Mark 6, verse 30. This is right after the story of John the Baptist being beheaded. That would be painful. to be thinking about when you heard that news. That had to be very disturbing. And at the same time, the disciples had been sent out, and they were told to go out and to preach the gospel. And they came back in verse 30. They gathered to Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. And he said to them, "Come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while." For there were many coming and going. They did not even have time to eat. You ever get by yourself? You ever find life like that? Where there's just so much thing, there's so many things coming and going. It may be people, it may be tasks. But you're almost too busy to eat, and you really do. You just need to go to a deserted place and rest for a while. We have to get away. We have to do that. So they departed to a deserted place in the boat by themselves. But the multitude saw them departing, and many knew him and ran there on foot from all the cities. And they arrived before them and came together to him. And sometimes you feel that way too. I know I need to rest, but life won't let me. It just won't let me. Slow down. You ever feel like you get to the end of the day and you have more items on your to-do list than you did when the day started? It happens. It happens all the time. And yet, Jesus, when he came out, saw a great multitude, and he was moved with compassion for them because they were like sheep not having a shepherd. So what did he do? Well, he did what he always did so well. He said, "Here's somebody with needs, and I'm going to help them." So he began teaching them many things. When the day was now far spent, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and already the hour is late. Send them away, that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy themselves bread. They have nothing to eat." Now their solution was, ignore their needs, get rid of them. His solution was to take care of their needs. But he answered and said to them, "You give them something to eat." And they said, "Well, we don't have any money. Are we going to do this?" And there follows the story about one of the miracles of the loaves and fishes. But then we come to verse 45. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he sent the multitude away. Maybe he thought by now, it'd be better if I told them to go rather than the disciples. They're not in a good mood about this. But he had taken care of the needs spiritually and physically. But there was a time to send them away. And when he had sent them away, he departed to the mountain to pray. At this point, even he needed to get away. He actually needed to get away from the disciples. He just needed to be by himself. He took a break to think and to pray and to plan. And it was intentional on his part. It didn't just happen. He didn't just say, "Oh, finally, things worked out where I could be by myself." No, he said, "You go this way. I'm going to go this way. I need to go up into the mountains and pray. I need to do this." Now later, you can read ahead. He goes back to work later, and a lot of people flooded to him. There were those who were seeking to learn, and there were those who were seeking to bother him, to accuse him, confront him, attack him. I have no doubt that in his human experience, he needed time away to recharge his batteries, so to speak, and to do the things necessary to prepare for the challenges that would be coming. And to do that, he went aside to pray. Now we find in this account then two critical concepts. Making time to think. And being in, this goes with the first one, making time to think and being in an environment that makes good thinking possible. Making time to think and being in an environment that makes good thinking possible. And then the second one is thinking in the right direction. It says he went to pray. Prayer is based on thinking. We pray to God about what we're thinking about. We think as we talk to God, if it's effective prayer. Christ didn't say, oh, you know, my mind needs a rest. I'm just going to go to the mountain and I'm going to veg out for a couple of days. That's not what he said. I'm not going to go up and veg out. I'm going to go up and pray. I'm going to go pray. I need to pray. You ever notice, and I'm sure you have, it's a rhetorical question, the deeper your thinking, the deeper your prayer. When you really are in one of these places where there's nothing from the outside that's bothering you, distracting you, and you're really zoning in on talking with God, and the more you think, the deeper your prayer is. That is not a surprise. It's the way life works. That point about making the right time and the right environment, addresses getting out of a set routine. Christ went to the mountains. He understood the way the mind works. Get out in creation. Don't contend with the radio, the TV, the telephone, the barking dogs, the four walls. There is something about getting out in nature. I think a couple or 3 years ago I gave a sermon here where I talked about this, but I'll repeat it again. You ever notice that getting out for a walk in the woods, sitting by a waterfall, walking along the beach, sitting in a meadow somewhere, looking at the animals grazing, looking out over a lake, any kind of natural environment, you notice what that does for the mind? How many of you are at Orange Beach? How many of you have said, you know, Britt Taylor told me this. He said, we got there a few days early and just walking on the beach, watching the sunset, listening to the waves, it's like all this tension melts away. Why is that? Why does that happen? Why does that do something for the mind? That peaceful, it affects the mood in a positive way. I had a conversation with somebody one time about that about 20 years ago. We were backpacking up in the mountains, and he said something that makes all the sense in the world, still makes all the sense in the world to me. He posed that question. He said, you ever wonder why a good walk in the woods just creates peace, gives you peace of mind? I said, no, I probably should have wondered that, but, you know. Why? And he said, well, I have a theory. He said, I have a theory. When you're out in creation, everything in God's creation works according to law. Everything works according to law. The leaves fall, the trees grow, the plants grow, the animals wander, the trees die, they fall, they return. He said, everything in creation works according to the physical laws that God created, laws of nature. You are in his environment, his creation that works according to law, and where law exists, exists what? Peace. Where law is, there is peace. Now, you don't think about it. You don't walk by the beach and just relax. You're not consciously saying, well, I know what's going on here. No, you don't even think about it. It's just there. But when you're in God's creation, there's something about it that's conducive to better thinking. You're in a lawful environment. You're in a lawful environment. Getting in the right environment is conducive to meditation. That's one reason God gave the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man, because one of the things about the Sabbath is that it's a big old stop sign every week in life where God says, stop, stop. All this stuff, all the clutter, all the business that's been going on all week, stop it. Just stop. It's a big stop sign, and what's it for then? What are we to do on the Sabbath? Think. It gives us time to think. Now, we have to use our time wisely, though. We can train ourselves to relax, to set time aside to meditate about life. You know, the World Series is starting next week. I love baseball. Love the game. A few years ago, I read a book by George Will. It was outside his normal writing of politics and world events. He wrote a book called Men at Work. It was about baseball. And he put in there, he said, you know, some people don't like baseball because they say it's too slow. It's boring. It's too slow. He said, when you understand everything that's going on and all the things that have to be considered with every play, every pitch, nine people on the field and one at bat and trying to figure it all out, he says, you realize for those who play the game, it goes too fast. You don't have enough time in between pitches to consider every strategic move that you need to be considering, where to place people, what pitch to throw, and all of that. We know the Sabbath is sort of the same way. Sort of the same way. It goes by too fast. And we don't have enough time on the Sabbath to really think about all the things that need to be thought about in life. There's so much in God's way that needs to be thought about. And even the Sabbath goes by too fast. But it's the best time we have. It's the best time we have. It's the best place to start. The mental and spiritual rest that comes from the Sabbath doesn't come from a mind not working. The mental and spiritual rest comes from a mind that is working on the things of God. And devoting the time to get all the clutter out, that's one of the greatest times there is. And then to go to the place, the time and place. That second factor that we see here is the discipline of thinking in the right direction. Thinking in the right direction. Again, Jesus went to pray. Again, prayer is based on thinking. We think as we talk to God. So what about this thing of thinking in the right direction? One of the most fundamental instructions is given in Philippians 4. Philippians 4, verse 8. Paul wrote here again about thinking. Philippians 4, 8. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. That's directional thinking. It's not just sitting back and saying, well, I'll think whatever comes to mind. No, it's concentrated. Say, I'm going to put my mind on these things. Sometimes it takes a while to get there. Sometimes it takes a while to have our minds align with this. Now, does this mean that there are never bad things that go through the mind? Well, no. I mean, you watch the news, you pick up the paper, you go to the store, you drive down the street, you're going to be exposed to negative. The negative is there. It's in our mind. But what he was saying is think about the full spectrum of life, and then this has to do with steering our thoughts in a certain direction. Steering our thoughts in a certain direction. Asking ourselves, okay, which direction am I going to go with this? I've seen something negative. I'm experiencing some trouble. I'm in a bad spot. How am I going to steer my mind? A lot of times people go to the worst case scenarios, and that's where they stick. They go to the negative. They go to the arguments that Paul wrote about that we read earlier in 2 Corinthians 10. They go to the things that exalt themselves above the knowledge of God. It's easy to do. We can sometimes not even realize it's going there. This tells us, turn the thoughts to the constructive. Are you in a bad situation? We're all in bad situations from time to time. We do get there. Don't abandon thoughts about faith. Don't abandon thoughts that he's speaking about here. When we're full of anxiety, and he says, be anxious for nothing, that's not easy. That's a battle, but it's a mental battle. But man, it's an important battle. To strive to think about, okay, what is it that's going to make me not anxious? How do I go that way? That's in verse 6. Don't abandon the things of God. Satan and the world is going to try to influence our thinking in the wrong way. The best way to fight it is with what we read right here. Let me illustrate with another story. I've given this in a sermon before some years ago, so I don't know, maybe you've heard it or haven't, but again, it bears repeating. One time, I got a call during the day from a lady, a church member, who was in a really dire financial situation. It was bad. And she was worried, she was fretting, consumed with it. She was almost, I'd say, panicked, because it was a bad situation. And is one of those things that after the first 30 seconds of the call, you realize, okay, I'm just going to shut up and listen for a while because she's got to get it out. And she must have gone for 15 minutes just pouring her heart out about her fears. And she was truly anguished and had reason to be. Finally, I thought, well, you know, I need to take control of the conversation a little bit. So I insisted, I said, okay, I understand now. Just stop and let me ask you some questions. And I'd been thinking about this while she was talking, and these were progressive questions. And by that, I mean, they were not random. I jotted some things down that were designed to lead down some logical steps to a conclusion I wanted her to get to. So I said, let me ask you a question. Just tell me yes or no. Do you believe in God? Well, yeah, but what does that have to do with my situation? No. Just, never mind. Just focus on my question. Do you believe in God? Yes. Is the Bible His Word? Yes. Did Christ die for you? Well, yes. Did you die for Him through repentance and baptism? Yes. Do you have the Holy Spirit? Yes. If you died today, do you think you'd be resurrected and be in the kingdom of God? Yes. Does God know your situation today? Yes. Did He promise He would never leave you or forsake you? Yes. Did David say he'd never seen the righteous begging bread? Yes. Do you have a congregation here that you're a part of that is supportive of every other member and is full of friends? Yes. Now, have you been working hard and struggling to do your part? Yes. Knew she had. Do you know how you're going to pay your bills? No. Do you think God can find a way? Yes. Over that 5 minutes or so, the conversation took on a totally different tone and direction. As we talked, a calmness began to settle over her. The enemy was being beaten back, is what was happening. The enemy of wrong thinking. The mind of the adversary who doesn't want us to have any confidence or faith in God, and she began thinking differently. At the end of the questions, I told her, I've just written a check for you out of the church's assistance fund. It's in the envelope. I'm going to put it in the mail to you as soon as we're off the phone. And she had this big sigh of relief. I was less worried about the money than I was where she was in the thinking. And it's easy to be there. What if our conversation had started, settled on, and ended with, do you know how you're going to pay your bills? If that's where the only thinking was, nothing would have changed. There's always more to the picture of life that we're not thinking about. There's always more to the picture of life than what we see at the time. And we have to meditate on these things. As he said here, meditate on these things. Now, sometimes it's hard. And in her case, she just needed somebody else to help her think in a different way. I can look back on so many times in my life, I've needed somebody else to help me think a different way. You know what counseling is really all about? It's talking to somebody else to get some other ways to think about something. That's really what it is. Because we go down these paths in our thinking. And in this case, it had consumed her thinking, and her worry was keeping her from putting God back into the picture. And when that happens, then a lack of faith increases. The thinking gets narrow. It's harder to think about the big questions of life first. That's what Paul was saying. Think on the big things of life. Think on the big things first, and then come back and work toward your specific issue that you're in right now. But if the issue we're in is the all-consuming big thing of life, and that's all we can think about, we're very unlikely to be able to do what verse 8 talks about. That is so important. I told her, I said, look, I've been there. I was able to tell her those things because those were some things I'd learned the hard way at times in life through experience. We all go there from time to time. And I know that not all problems are as easily solved as hers. It's naive to think, well, every problem just has a check written for it. That's not the case in life, is it? A lot of times it's not that way. You know, sometimes think about Ephesians 6:13, where it talks about the armor of God. There's a statement there that says, put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Sometimes you're in life and you've done everything you can do, and all you can do is stand and wait. You stand and wait until the evil is gone. It's all you can do. Stand until the storm passes. But here's the thing. While we stand, we think. While we stand, we think. And the way we think will affect the strength with which we stand. That's why Proverbs 16:3 says, commit your works to the Lord and your thoughts will be established. Commit your works to the Lord and your thoughts will be established. Well, what is commitment? That's another way of thinking. Commitment is just another way of thinking. Going to God and being honest with Him and saying, man, I'm in a lot of trouble. Life is hard right now. I have these problems. I'm struggling with worry, but I am committed to following you. I am committed to following you. God says, commit your works to God and your thoughts will be established. That's knowing that God is committed to me. That's thinking about a bigger picture. That's keeping the mind on the big picture. And then you look for examples in life of what Paul is talking about here. Things that are true. Things that are noble and just and lovely and good report, virtuous. And you meditate on those things. Think about those things. Those who don't do that just sort of bounce from crisis to crisis. And when the trial comes, they find it difficult to look on these things. They find it difficult to look back on the past and remember what God has done and to draw faith from that. I mentioned earlier about Psalm 73. Let's go there. This was Asaph writing. And this is a common experience of human beings. Something that is easy to lose sleep over. It's something to just get in a bad attitude about. You know, it is something that just happens to every person where you look at life and you realize it's not fair. And life isn't fair. Psalm 73, this offers some really great insight to the thinking process. And Asaph was inspired to write this, and he was very honest with what he went through. He begins in verse 1 saying, truly God is good to Israel, to such as are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. Over what? For For I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. And you can see that today too. You can see it all the time. Envy comes from thinking. Thinking wrongly. And it's easy to go there. But that's only one way of seeing a situation. I turned on the news this morning. They said, no winners in the Powerball. It's up to today, $1.6 billion. What will it be next Friday when it rolls around? Way far past. And somebody or some group of people is going to win that thing. And it's not fair, is it? Somebody is going to win $1 billion for doing nothing. For doing nothing. You can say, I am out there every day beating my head against the wall, doing everything I can, barely scraping by. What if it's some sleazy person who wins that lottery? Somebody who not only is doing nothing, they're not even worthy of it. You think, what I could do? Oh, you know, I'd give half of it to the church. What we could do, you know. And it's just the way life is. But it's easy to get envious. He saw something. He started thinking about it. His thinking went down a wrong path. And he was meditating all right, but he was meditating in a wrong way. And he goes on to talk about other people. And then it starts getting exaggerated. He says, there's no pangs in their death. You know, nothing bothers them. They're not in trouble like other people. They're proud. They have violence. Their eyes bulge with abundance. They have more than their heart could wish. They scoff and speak wickedly. They speak loftily. They even talk against God. They say in verse 11, how does God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? These are the ungodly who are always at ease. They increase in riches. So he's looking at them and thinking about how unjust it is, how they just skate by. And then in verse 13, he starts looking at what he's trying to do as a follower of God. And he says, surely I've cleansed my heart in vain. I've washed my hands in innocence. All day long I've been plagued. I'm chastened every morning. And then he said in verse 15, if I talk about it, that's not right either. I would be untrue to the generation of your children. And in verse 16, he says, when I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me. There are some things in life that when God is out of the picture, and just looking at the circumstances as they exist, and you, the more you think about it, the worse it gets. He was stuck in a rut of thinking. It wasn't the Philippians 4:8 model. He was just going down that road. That's a bad place to end up. But something changes for him. He says in verse 17, until I went into the sanctuary of God, and I understood their end. He said, I had to think about a bigger picture of life. If I'm just judging life on what's happening here and now, that's missing a big part of the picture. God tells us, look at the end of things. Look at the end of where life is going. What is this all about? He begins to think differently. He said, I understood. What is understanding? Just thinking. It all has to do with thinking. Understanding comes with a different thinking, with new thinking. Looking at things a different way, the mind going in a different direction, getting another part of the picture. And he goes on to describe how he started thinking differently. He started seeing things. He started seeing the reality of life for people in the world. And that was important. One of the great benefits of spending time in meditation is that meditation allows you to walk around an issue and look at it from many different sides. When you have time to meditate, you can put this issue on the table and walk around it and look at it from all angles until you begin to see it from God's point of view. If we get stuck at one angle, we are stuck in our own thinking. But to ask God, help me to see this from your point of view. Help me to think about it the way you think about it. Help me to see things. Even when we think we're seeing things right, to ask God, watch my heart, watch my thoughts, show me if I'm thinking out of line. This chapter shows us two totally different trains of thought that took place in one man's mind. And that's the way we are as humans. One was negative, it could have been very destructive to him, but it eventually turned into something positive. Got off of that narrow path. He went into the sanctuary of God. What does that mean? Well, it means to do exactly what Christ did. He set aside time to go and pray and think, to be with God in prayer, to study His Word, to put his mind on God's plan, what God is doing. And it changed his thinking. A few verses later, he even records some thoughts about his thoughts. Verse 21. Thus my heart was grieved, and I was vexed in my mind. I was so foolish and ignorant. I was like a beast before you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold me by my right hand. You will guide me with your counsel, and afterward receive me to glory. So important. Philippians 4, 6, where we were earlier, won't turn there, but it says, In prayer, make your request be known to God. Asking God, help me with my request, but one of the most important things to pray for that ought to be part of our regular prayers, help me think. Help me think correctly. While we're here in Psalm, let's go back to Psalm 55. Psalm 55, verse 17, has an interesting statement. David wrote, "Evening and morning and at noon, I will pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice." The word for pray there is not one of the more common words in the Bible for the word pray. The word for pray here is, in Hebrew, siach, S-I-A-C-H. And literally, it means to ponder. It can be interpreted to converse with oneself, to utter. It's translated commune, complain, declare, meditate, muse, pray, speak, talk with. It's the same word, it's the same root word that we read in Genesis 24, 63, where it says Isaac went out to meditate in the field at eventide. Same word. And by the way, that thing about Isaac, went out to meditate in the field at evening. Right time, right place, get off somewhere, that principle. It's even translated, I believe, in some areas in Psalm 55, 17, evening, morning, and noon, I will bow down to meditate. I will bow down to meditate. Prayer is an excellent time, not only for talking with God, but for thinking with God. You pray a little bit, think a little bit. It's another reason why prayer is important. It gives us time to think. There's nothing wrong with pausing in a prayer to think. Asking God, help me to be thinking and to be thinking about these things and praying about it. What is interesting about siach is how you find it in other places. Just a few real quick. Chapter 119. Chapter 119, same word. Verse 15. Psalm 119, 15, I will meditate, siach, on your precepts and contemplate your ways. Again, small minds discuss people, average minds discuss events, great minds discuss ideas. Which one does this fall into? Meditating on God's precepts and contemplating your ways. That's greater thinking. It's much greater thinking. That's going into the things that are the deepest. How many times have I found myself in life thinking about the people that were bothering me instead of thinking about the ways of God that I need to think about to deal with the people that were bothering me? You know, it's easy to get focused on the narrow. When God says, think about the bigger. Think about my precepts. Contemplate my ways. Verse 23. Princes also sit and speak against me, but your servant meditates on your statutes. Thinking about the things of God again. His principles, his mind. Verse 48. And again, every time the word meditate here is used, it's siach. Same word used for pray earlier. Verse 48. My hands also I will lift up to your commandments, which I love, and I will meditate on your statutes. What does God tell me to do? His laws, his statutes, his precepts. That which is of God that directs our thinking instead of our emotions directing our thinking. Verse 148, same chapter, verse 148. My eyes are awake through the night watches, that I may meditate on your word. Ever wake up in the middle of the night? Mind racing? Best thing to do is grab hold of the mind and say, okay, I'm awake. I'm going to lie here and pray. I'm going to lie here and pray. Sometimes you find your mind wandering off, but you can pull it back. You can pull it back. As an aside, you may make a note on verse 148 of Psalm 63, verses 5 and 6. David said, when I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the night watches, remembering God even on your bed. I remember being surprised one time. I heard Mr. Armstrong say, I try to fall asleep praying. I try to fall asleep praying. Fall asleep praying? Isn't that disrespectful? That's not what he meant. Now, if you're giving the closing prayer at church and you fall asleep praying, or at the dinner table, or if you're on your knees at your office and you're bowed down to pray and you fall asleep, that's different. But what he was talking about, he said, the last thing I want on my mind when I go to sleep at night is to be talking with God. That's what he meant. The last thing on my mind. That's what David said in Psalm 119, verse 97. He said, it's my meditation all the day. All the day, all the way up to the end of the day. Keep coming back to God's thoughts. So important. Verse 59. Psalm 119, verse 59. When we do that, here's what happens. I thought about my ways and turned my feet to your testimonies. When we're thinking about God's ways, we can't help but then think about our ways. And then we apply it, God's law, to our lives, and it turns us around. There's so many ways to reflect on the law of God, the letter and the spirit, the precepts, the principles. Cause and effect, what works, what doesn't work in life. It's so important. Psalm 143. There are a couple of places here where the Psalms touch powerfully on one of the most important times for meditation and one of the most important subjects for meditation when we're in those times. There are times in life that are dangerous, times of stress and trouble that will come upon us, as we heard in the sermonette. And those are times when we have to be very careful with our thinking. So in Psalm 143, in verse 4, David wrote, therefore, my spirit is overwhelmed within me. My heart within me is distressed. I remember days of old. I meditate on all your works. I muse on the work of your hands. That is really important. As time goes by in life, and you think about life that has gone by in your life or maybe other people's, and he said, I remember the days of old. Sometimes we have to look back in order to see ahead. And at times of trial, it's important to look back. Okay, I've been through things before. Did God get me through it? Yep. I meditate on all of your works. I muse on the work of your hands. That is what is really, really important. As Job 32 says, there's a spirit in man, and the inspiration of the Almighty gives them understanding. God will inspire the mind. God will inspire the thoughts of someone who is striving to think this way. And finally, Psalm 77. There are many other scriptures in here. I'm not covering nearly all of them, but Psalm 77. The Psalms are full of these concepts about the way we think. David said, Asaph, he said, I cried to God, cried out with my voice, and he gave ear to me and said, in the day of my trouble, verse 2, I sought the Lord. But then he talks about, this was a rough time. He said, my soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God. That's good. But then he says, I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Verse 4, you hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search. And then he asks a series of questions. Will the Lord cast off forever? Will he be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Sometimes you get to those points where those questions come to mind. And those are legitimate questions as human beings. We ask these things, but there are also other things to think about besides these. And he says here, I need to remember some other things too. He said, this is my anguish, verse 10. But I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. In other words, I'm not seeing what I want to see right now, but I can see what's happened before. And I can't take those things, I can't dismiss those things, push them out of the picture. Verse 12, I will also meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? You are the God who does wonders. You have declared your strength among the peoples. You have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. And he spends the rest of the chapter reflecting on the elements of God. The big element here was faith. That was the big issue. Faith in troubled times. You see people go through troubled times. Some handle it differently than others. Much differently. And the key is in the way we think. God's thoughts, meditation on godly things creates stability. It helps us with faith. And faith has everything to do with the way we think. It's totally about the way we think. There's so much to think about when it comes to thinking. And again, we've just touched on a few. But let me leave you with this, and that is that God has given us this marvelous creation of the mind. And along with our mind and our spirit and man, he's given us his spirit. And in this mind, two amazing functions take place. We are able to collect and store information in our minds. And then we are able to process it and determine what we're going to do in life. It's amazing. The mind is a marvelous tool, but without the influence of God, it's a dangerous tool. It can go the wrong way. So God tells us, use the mind, be thinkers, think a lot. Use this creation that I've given you, but do it in the right way. Guided thinking, meditation is tremendous. It opens the doors to godly living. I was requested before I came this morning to give a sermon, a title, for whoever takes care of the recordings. I thought about that for a while. The title that I sent in, if you like a title, is I Think, Therefore, dot, dot, dot. It's based on one of the most famous statements about thinking by René Descartes, the French philosopher, who said, I think, therefore I am. I think, therefore I am. It's one of the things that makes us human. He needed to add more to that statement. For humanity, we could say, I think, therefore I'm always in a mess. I'm always in trouble. Because man's thinking is what's gotten us to this place in life. But understand, God lifts us to a higher plane. You can probably think of a better way to word it, but I would say, think like I am, says God, and then you can be like I am.